This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. It's time for the February episode of Radio Astronomy. I'm news editor Elizabeth Pearson, and I'm joined on the podcast today by staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later in the episode, editor Chris Bramley and our reviews editor Paul Money will be taking a look at the observing highlights that are coming up in 2021. But first, me and Ian are going to look at some of the things that are coming up in terms of spaceflight and science in the next year. And probably the biggest one that's coming up is all of the missions that are due to get to Mars this February. So back in July, not one, but three separate space missions began their journey to the Red Planet. Every 26 months, there is a launch window when the planets Earth and Mars are aligned such that you can make the shortest trip. So if you're trying to get to Mars, that's the time you want to launch. And the last one was back in July. And they're all due to make their approach in February throughout the month. So we're going to have a lot of news coming from the Red Planet at that time. There's a big NASA mission that's happening, and that NASA mission is the Perseverance rover. And this is kind of the culmination of a huge project that's been going on for decades and decades, which is to try and actually bring back samples of Mars rock from the Red Planet to Earth. Perseverance itself won't actually be doing that. What it will be doing is it will be roving around the surface, picking up rocks and dust and creating little sample caches. It's going to store them in like these giant test tubes, sort of overgrown test tubes, that it will then club together and leave in certain places across the Mars surface where a future mission that is currently being planned by ESA and NASA will come along, pick up those samples and return them to Earth, hopefully within the next decade. You know, this is a mission that people have been talking about since we first started going to Mars, since we first started going to the moon, like 60 years ago, people have been wanting to do this. And we're finally actually beginning to make progress to it finally actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, that concept of landing on Mars and then lifting off again. I mean, that lifting off from Mars and getting back to Earth, that must be just be one of the kind of toughest aspects of the mission.
Yeah, it's useful in that when, if you're not bringing people back, if you're just sending robots, then you don't need to bring as much stuff back with you. It's perfectly fine to just leave a robot on the surface of Mars. People tend to get a bit annoyed if you do that with people. So the return capsule is going to be much, much smaller than, you know, the Perseverance rover. The Perseverance rover is sort of going to be the size of like a car. Mm-hmm. It's not a small thing. But the actual return capsule will probably only be, you know, like the size of a shoebox, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how big that they're planning on making that, which does make launching a lot easier. Still challenging, but a lot easier. And it's actually going to end up being a three-part mission. So Perseverance is the first part. Then you've got the second part, which is the bit that goes and lands on the surface, picks up the samples, and then launches it into Mars orbit again,
mm-hmm.
which is an entire mission in itself. And then you have a third mission, which goes along, captures that sample or thing that's in orbit, and then brings it back to Earth. So you've got these kind of three different stages that have got to happen. There's a lot of moving parts. So hopefully it should all go to plan.
Yeah. And I suppose this all sort of pertains back to, you know, the question of what was Mars like in its ancient history? Was it wet?
Mm-hmm.
If so, did life ever exist there?
Exactly. These are the big questions. And while previous rovers and previous landers have done a pretty good job of getting an idea of what Mars is like today, Curiosity and those the Spirit, Opportunity, all of those rovers have done a good job of tracking water on Mars, or the history of water on Mars. That's always the big question. There's still only so much stuff, so much equipment that you can put on these rovers, these landers. You can miniaturize stuff down quite a lot, but there's still only so much you can do when you're having to send your lab to Mars. It's much more efficient to take your sample, bring it back to Earth, and then you can look at it in the biggest, most advanced laboratories in the entire world. It's a much better way of doing things.
Yeah, and also, you know, as we've seen with sort of, like, for example, the rocks brought back from the Apollo missions, you know, you can mm-hmm. you can store them for future generations when
absolutely
when technology's better, when we, you know a bit more of what we're looking for. Future planetary scientists will be able to access those in decades to come and study them.
Yeah, it's very much it's about the long game.
Yeah.
With these missions, it's not. I mean, Perseverance, when it eventually lands, I'm sure NASA will make a big deal about it and they'll send back loads of selfies and do all of the things that they've done for the other rovers. But it's the real scientific payoff is going to be quite a long game. So that's one to watch. However, NASA, they've been at Mars since the 1970s. They've done lots of things there. The other two missions that are currently on the way to Mars, it's their first ever time that they will be attempting to approach Mars. In fact, in one case, it's their first time they've done a planetary mission at all. We have China, who are sending their Tianwen-1 mission, and that consists of both a orbiter that will stay in orbit and act as a relay station, and a landing station and rover. The precise details of what this will do and what they hope to achieve is a bit vague. China aren't terribly good at telling the rest of the world what it is that they're trying to do. But it is part, again, of China's long-term goals of really becoming a powerhouse in the field of space flight and space exploration. They are making incredible leaps and bounds. The amount that they've come on, that Chinese Space Agency has come on in the last couple of years is quite amazing. Building on the successes and what previous missions such as by NASA and the Soviet Union have learned. You've probably heard a lot of, we've talked on the podcast previously about their Chang'e series, which is on the moon. Tianwen is going to be a very similar thing, but on Mars. So it'll have a tiny rover. And the rover is mostly about how do you operate on Mars? There will be doing some science on it. It has got some scientific equipment of it on the rover. But it will be mostly teaching the Chinese exactly how do you work and operate on Mars.
Do we expect much sort of collaboration between NASA and the Chinese Space Agency with regard to their, or are they sort of like a, you know, far-flung corners of the red planet and they won't actually, you know, talk to each other that much?
They have to talk to each other to make sure that there's going to be no crashes.
Yeah.
And NASA is very open with their data. So it's there for anyone to use. And China has been using it as well. I know that there's a lot of people at NASA who would like to be more involved with the Chinese. But there is a law in the US for various political reasons. NASA is not allowed to collaborate in a lot of ways with China on space.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think any US company is allowed to collaborate with Chinese companies when it comes to space flight, which has caused quite a few problems over the years. I know that Chinese are working very strongly with a lot of European countries, though. They've worked with DLR, which is the German space agency, on various bits of the Chang'e rovers and so on. So there is definitely a lot of collaboration going on, not as much as you might expect, not as much as someone say like NASA does, but there is still a fair amount of collaboration going on there. Be interesting to see how that one progresses. And then finally, we have the Hope Orbiter, which is from the United Arab Emirates. And the UAE is actually a fairly recent entrant into the sort of world of spaceflight. It's only been, you know, sending up missions for the past couple of decades. Its HOPE probe is going to stay in orbit. It's not going to land, this one. And it will be looking at the atmospherics and dust storms and gases being lost to space. And again, this is part of the UAE's approach to trying to become a space power. It's part of the nation's sort of long-term scientific goals of setting itself forward as a kind of progressive, technologically advanced in that sphere in the world stage. So spaceflight is a lot more political than you think it is. But that'll be really interesting to see, because it's a dedicated, basically, meteorological station just looking at the weather and the atmosphere around Mars, which is incredibly, like, interesting. It'll be looking at gases being lost to space. And whenever you talk about Mars, though it's not the only scientific interesting thing about it, people always talk about the potential of habitability and the potential for life or sending people to Mars. And knowing exactly what's going on with the atmosphere and what it might have been like in the past is vital to being able to answer those questions.
Yeah, that's right. When the UAE press release came out last year, and one of the things that they'd sort of said about the HOPE mission was that it's going to be able to, you know, potentially help with sort of like weather forecasting on Mars, because, you know, people mm-hmm. will know about these sort of horrendous dust storms that can engulf the planet. And if you've got human beings working and living on Mars, and that could be potentially, potentially pretty lethal. But it's interesting just because those, you know, sort of those the NASA missions looking at Mars's past and, you know, its ancient history and whether or not it was wet. And it's really interesting, those aspects of the Mars missions that are sort of looking to the future and the prospect of getting humans in there. Because one of the things I was going to say earlier on in the podcast is this kind of sample collection and return missions, it's sort of the next step to actually getting geologists on Mars. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could, imagine if you could actually get human geologists with labs to live and work on Mars. I mean, just wonder, like, is that within the realms of our lifetimes, do you think, Ez?
I think it's a possibility. Yeah. I think we might see it. We might be old and we might be grey when it happens, but I hope that we would. There's a lot of people who are now making, because it's always been one of those things that's like, oh yes, we're going to send people to Mars, but now people are making a concerted effort.
Yeah.
And with companies like SpaceX and Blue Origins and things like that, and Boeing creating crew capsules. It's not an easy word to say. I think that people will get to Mars. The question is it going to be a government? Is it going to be a private company? Is it just going to be, you know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk with their billions and billions of dollars?
I know. So
it's an interesting time to be in, to see this evolving. But we'll worry about the moon first, I think, when it comes to that.
Yeah, I suppose one of the other big stories potentially this year, hopefully, is the James Webb Space Telescope, because after years of delays, JWST is due to finally launch on Halloween this year, 31st of October 2021. Anyone who's been following this story will know that, you know, in 2018, launch was delayed till 2020, and then last year it was delayed again due to coronavirus. You know, coronavirus kind of just messed everything up last year, didn't it? Mm-hmm. But it was interesting reading that some of the stuff that actually got done with the JWST project last year, despite all the complications that came with, you know, a global pandemic. So they were able to do deployment testing of JWST's large mirrors. Anyone who's seen a picture of the James Webb Space Telescope will, the first thing you notice is the huge hexagonal gold plated mirrors. So they've sort of been testing unfurling those, and they've been testing, like, folding the telescope up, because it has to be folded up to fit into the Ariane 5 launcher, and then it'll be, like, unfurled in space. And they've been testing the ability to command the instruments remotely. They've been systems checks. So just, you know, despite COVID-19 and all the problems that came with that last year, JWST team still have obviously made a lot of progress. And yes, towards the end of the year, it's planned to be launched. And it's really sort of one of the things that people say about it is that it's sort of a successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. It's going to be able to collect, like, six times more light than Hubble. And I suppose that's sort of the basis upon which they're sort of, NASA are sort of, well, almost, you know, selling it to the public, for want of a better word. But yeah, you know, this the JWST, when it's operating and when scientists start studying the data, start studying its data, has the potential to sort of retell the story of the universe, you know, because it's going to be able to peer so deep into the universe that it can see what the early universe was like, because that light from shortly after the Big Bang, those first stars and galaxies, is, you know, takes billions of years to get to Earth. So the further back in time, the further into space you look, the further back in time you effectively look. So JWST could potentially give scientists evidence and clues as to, you know, how the first stars formed, potentially even how our solar system formed. And it can look in infrared, because that light, as it's traveling across space for those billions of years, it gets sort of stretched by the expansion of the universe. And so that it's sort of red shifted. So the JWST's infrared vision will be able to help scientists see that and, you know, gather information about the birth and assembly of galaxies. Also clues about dark matter and dark energy as well. Those, you know, sort of burning questions relating to gravity and the acceleration of the expansion of the universe. And sort of a bit maybe sort of less cosmological, it's also going to be observing the atmospheres of potentially habitable exoplanets, like the famous TRAPPIST-1 system that most people will know about, those Earth-like planets that were discovered a few years ago. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people will probably be kind of, you know, fairly jokingly cynical about JWST because there have been quite a few delays, but it looks like 2021 is going to finally be the year that it's launched.
It definitely looks like it is on track.
Yeah.
There's a chance it might get delayed, but it's we're talking delays of 6 months, not years.
Yeah.
It's because, you know, this is like my entire time that I've been doing this job. And like, even when I was doing my PhD, it was always people were like, oh, we're building the JWST. It'll happen. It'll come. And it finally, you know, sort of like 10 years down the road, it's finally possibly going up is again, it's really interesting, exciting to see. I'm interested to see what the pictures look like, because everybody, you know, they talk about it being the successor to Hubble, but it's actually a very different telescope. It's like, if you look at the pictures, the most notable difference is it's not silver, it's gold. Because it's looking at infrared, and infrared reflects better on gold, in case anybody was wondering why that was. Yeah, I'm just really, because also that, you know, like the Hubble images have become so iconic, you know, like the whole Hubble palette thing when you're creating astro images. It's like, will we have a JWST palette?
Oh, imagine that. Yeah, astrophotographers using the JWST palette. That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
That would be interesting. It's a bit trickier to take. The whole reason why you put an IR infrared telescope up in space is because the atmosphere tends to eat it. Eat infrared light coming from distant galaxies and things. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, you know, when you think about Hubble's images, you know, the first images that Hubble sent back were faulty because there was an issue with the optics. And then various space shuttle missions saw NASA astronauts going and fixing it, basically, and then updating it throughout the years. But that's not going to be possible with JWST. It's going to be 1.5 million kilometers from Earth. So probably take quite a bit to send an astronaut out there to fix the JWST. So, you know,
a little bit.
Yeah. So that's also one thing that has to be taken into consideration when you look at sort of setbacks and delays with the project. I mean, they've got to get it right.
Yeah, there's no redos on this one.
No, that's it.
I think one of the other things to me that's really interesting is, because it's taking such a long time, and bear in mind that with like massive missions like this, it might take 10 years to build it, but there was another 10, 20 years before that where they were planning it. And so they were first considering this like back in the 1990s, like they had Hubble, what's next? And back then, they didn't know about exoplanets, really. The first ones were only discovered in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And so when they were designing it, they had no idea that JWST might be useful to look at the atmospheres of exoplanets. Now, that's a thing it might be doing. So I just think that's, you know, that's one of those reasons why you build these incredible machines, is to do the thing you know, but also it might end up being really useful for a thing you don't know about yet. Now, the JWST will be quite far away from Earth. It'll be 1.5 million kilometers away, as Ian said. But a little closer to home is the moon. And there's actually quite a lot of stuff going on at the moon in 2021, or at least around it. The first missions that will be hopefully heading off at some point in late 2021 is the Indian Space Research Organizations, or ISRO, will be sending a redo of their Chandrayaan-2 mission, called Chandrayaan 3, funnily enough. And so you might remember that back in September 2019, India tried to land on the moon with their Vikram lander as part of their Chandrayaan 2 mission. And it failed at the last minute. Just as they were coming in close to land, one of the rockets, one of the thrusters, went awry. The thing flipped over and it ended up crashing into the surface. They got very close, but just at the last minute, things went wrong. So they are now redoing the mission in late 2021. And so hopefully India will be getting to land on the surface of the moon. Now, obviously, they are not the only nation that's trying to get to the moon. We've already talked about China, who are currently there at the minute. In fact, at the end of the year, they actually did a sample return mission from the moon in a couple of weeks. Sent a mission, blasted off, and came back with a sample of moon rock. But also, the other people who are very vocal about trying to get to the moon are NASA. But they're not going with robots. They're trying to go with people. And they are hoping at the end of this year that they will be able to launch their Artemis 1 mission, which is going to be the first big, big step towards their Artemis mission, which is their mission to put the first woman on the surface of the moon. And this will be the test of two big aspects of that. The Space Launch System, which is the heavy launch rocket that is going to carry everybody to the moon, basically the equivalent of the Saturn V that launched the Apollo missions, and also the Orion crew capsule. Neither of these have been tested before, so it'll be an interesting situation to see how that happens. Whether or not it will happen this year or next year is a bit of a question at the moment. There was an issue with the Space Launch System. They were running a test at the end of 2020 and it got delayed just by a couple of weeks for various reasons. And that has unfortunately put the timeline, it's not put the timeline in jeopardy yet, but it has shortened the amount of wiggle room they have. So if anything else goes wrong on the Space Launch System, there could be some issues.
Yeah.
The deadline for the final Artemis mission, the one that will land a person, the first woman on the surface of the moon, is for 2024, which was initially supposed to tie in with Trump's, the end of President Trump's second term, if he got one. He hasn't. So there is now a question about whether or not NASA are going to be as fervent about getting that 2024 deadline. Well, that's, again, another political question. We'll have to see what happens when the new administration comes in, which hasn't happened at the time of recording.
No, I think it's really interesting, this notion of, you know, it's almost sort of like looking towards a permanent human presence on the moon. And it sort of reminds me of that statistic, fun fact that everyone mentions when talking about the legacy of the International Space Station, is that, you know, anyone born after a certain time when the ISS has existed has never been alive when there wasn't everyone else on the Earth. If you know what I mean, if I said that correctly. So beyond a certain time after the launch of the ISS, there hasn't been a time when every single human being has been on Earth.
Yeah.
And so once this permanent presence on the moon is sort of implemented, and there's, you know, potentially an overlap of crews, then we're potentially looking at a situation where there will always be a human being on the moon. And I find that really, really mind-blowing to consider.
Yeah. That's a big one, because even when you're talking about the International Space Station in low Earth orbit, they're still not that far away.
Mm.
The International Space Station, I don't think, goes more than about 400 kilometers away from Earth at any point.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, the distance between Bristol, where we are, and, you know, London and back. That's hardly, that's no distance at all. So the idea that they're going to the moon, which is more like 400,000 kilometers away, that's quite a big difference, you know, that they're really going away from home at that point.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Yeah. And again, you know, sort of like we were saying with the JWST, that just that extra distance just makes it a bit more, you know, a bit more sort of risky, dangerous. I mean, if something something goes wrong on the ISS, you know, it's not within the realms of possibility to fairly quickly send up a rescue mission.
Yeah.
But if you've got to get to the moon, you know, at a moment's notice, then things become a bit more tricky, don't they? So it's just that little bit of extra risk involved. But no, it's been interesting, all the stuff that's been happening over the past few years in terms of, you know, the discovery of water ice on the moon and things like that. Because people talk about, you know, water being an amazing resource in terms of, you know, breaking it down into oxygen or, you know, turning it into coolant for rocket launchers. You know, you could put a telescope on the moon, you could launch missions from the moon. You know, it's sort of the fact that it's taken us this long to get back to the moon since Apollo. A lot of people find frustrating, but if we're able to go back with a better idea of what we can do and the capabilities and better technology, then perhaps it was worth the wait after all, you know?
Yeah. And actually, it's more than just a bunch of testing the equipment. There is actually going to be some experiments that will run during Artemis 1. For instance, there is going to be several experiments which are going to look more detail of the water ice that you were just talking about. There's also quite a few experiments measuring the effects of space radiation, because one of the problems with going that far away from Earth is that you're away from Earth's protective magnetic field, and so radiation is a much bigger problem. So one of the things that they're going to do is they are going to send some yeast to see what happens to yeast when you affect it, dose it with a bunch of space radiation. And they're also going to send two female mannequins, because it's the Artemis mission to send the first women, which are going to be wearing radiation vests, or at least one of the mannequins will be wearing a special astrorad radiation vest and the other one won't be. And these mannequins are going to have a bunch of sensors on to see how well these radiation vests are at protecting humans from the effects of space radiation. Again, that is a thing that when we were just sending the Apollo astronauts and they were only going for a couple of days at a time, the radiation wasn't a big deal. But if you've got people living there permanently, it becomes something that we begin to need to worry about.
Yeah.
So one of the ways they're hoping to combat it is with special vests and clothing that will help absorb the radiation. And hopefully look rather swanky at the same time. Looking at the pictures earlier, they look quite... There's definitely some space-age styling going on.
Cool. Yeah, but from sort of crewed missions to back to uncrewed missions, another one of the big stories this year is going to be OSIRIS-REx, which sort of following on the heels of Japan's Hayabusa 2 mission, is a sample collection mission at a near-Earth asteroid called Bennu. Now, OSIRIS-REx... arrived at Bennu in December 18, and it's due to return this sample of the asteroid itself in 2023, a bit like what we were discussing with Perseverance and the Mars mission. And as we've said in the podcast before, you know, this interest in sort of comets and asteroids is because they are these primordial specimens left over from the formation of the solar system. So studying them gives you clues as to what the early solar system was like. You can learn potentially about the emergence of life, how water was delivered to our planet's oceans. And, you know, Bennu itself is rich in water and organic molecules. So that's why it was such a good target for study. Since arriving at the asteroid, the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft has been mapping the surface, studying its chemistry, topography, mineralogy. And recently it successfully stowed a sample of Bennu, which it collected by sort of tapping the asteroid, for want of a better word, sort of blasting nitrogen onto its head, and this causes particles to fly off and into a storage compartment. There was an issue last October. There was a fear that the spacecraft had captured so much material that it was leaking, But the latest from NASA says that they've ensured that the sample is safe and it's due to return in September 2023. And as we were saying with, you know, Perseverance and, you know, the Apollo samples, these are samples that you can study and you can also store for generations to come. Future PhD students and, you know, scientists will be looking at the OSIRIS-REx samples for decades to come.
I always think it's surprising that we haven't been to an asteroid before. I mean, I know the original Hayabusa mission tried back in the early 2000s, but it's, you know, we've been to, like, we went, landed on a comet before we landed on an asteroid. And that just seems a bit backwards to me. Especially because when you look at most missions that are going into the outer solar system, they always send back a couple of pictures of an asteroid because the things are everywhere. It's just like, Well, we happened to be flying past it, so we snapped a couple of shots.
Yeah, and especially when you consider, you know, something like the Rosetta mission around Comet 67P, you know, the fact that it was like it followed 67P in its orbit around the sun, but also, I mean, put a lander on it. I mean, yeah, fair enough, like the lander didn't really work, it sort of bounced off the surface, but they still did it, and they still sent back, you know, data from that lander. They effectively landed on a comet. But, you know, Bennu and Hayabusa 2 aren't really even landing. Well, Hayabusa 2 did send rovers down, but, you know, like OSIRIS-REx is just, it's just tapping and going, really, isn't it? And but yeah, that I mean, it brings you back to just how amazing that European Space Agency Rosetta mission was.
It's actually more difficult to land on something that's small because it's the escape velocity, which is basically the speed that at which you bounce off it and launch yourself into orbit again, is so low. If you were standing on the surface if you were standing on the surface of the Rosetta comet, most people could jump and escape it.
Whoa.
And so you've got to come down and land extremely, extremely carefully and really match speeds to be able to actually land on the surface and stay there. So, yeah, it's surprisingly difficult, but people have managed it.
And as we were recording this, we were due to talk about the end of NASA's Juno mission at Jupiter, which arrived at Jupiter on the 4th of July in 2016 and has just completely blown everyone's minds with just its images and its data of, you know, Jupiter's tempestuous atmosphere and its great red spot and its, you know, polar cyclones and, you know, its belts and zones, these cloud bands, and just absolutely incredible images. And the Prime mission is due to be completed in July 2021. But as we're recording, NASA has just announced an extension of the mission. So Juno is going to have an extended secondary mission, which is going to continue until September 2025 or until the end of the spacecraft's life, I guess, whichever comes first. And the expansion is going to be looking at, and the expanded mission is going to see Juno explore the whole of the Jovian system, so Jupiter and its rings and its moons. It's going to be flying around three of Jupiter's so-called Galilean moons, Ganymede, Europa, and Io. And it's going to expand on what the mission has already discovered about its interior structure, its magnetic field, its atmosphere, its magnetosphere, and as I said before, those incredible storms. I mean, it's interesting thinking about the Juno mission in terms of the physics of its orbit, because it makes these huge loops, sort of like almost like an elliptical orbit, whereby it goes really far out and then comes back in to do these sort of grazing close flybys. And as it does that, that's where we've got these amazing close-up images of the Great Red Spot and things like that. But the other thing that's really interesting is it's a polar orbit. So for the first time ever, we were able to see what the north and south poles of the planet looked like, because most people will recognize an image of Jupiter as being, you know, that stripy appearance with the Great Red Spot. But if someone were to show you a picture of its south pole without telling you what it was before the Juno mission, you probably wouldn't have guessed that it was Jupiter. And it's discovered all sorts of things, you kind of mapping Jupiter's aurora. So, you know, Earth's not the only planet that has aurorae. It's been sort of peering through the clouds down in the depths of the Great Red Spot and learning about the water makeup of its atmosphere. And, you know, one of the things that I've really enjoyed is the images that have come back from JunoCam, because they have pretty much exclusively been processed by citizen scientists, to an extent that I personally haven't seen in a mission before. So if you, I'm sure you can Google it, you just go on the JANUCAM website and you can download the raw data that NASA makes available that the spacecraft has collected. And you can use Photoshop or any other imaging software that you have, and you can actually process the images for yourself and make them your own. And people do that, you know, from the people who are really into it and make these amazing, realistic views of what Jupiter would look like if you could see it. To quite funny things, people sort of do like Van Gogh inspired images of Jupiter and things like that. And that's been one of the things I've really enjoyed seeing of the Jupiter mission is just kind of that aspect of citizen science that, as you said before, you know, NASA is so good at promoting.
And also, if you are a person who that kind of thing appeals to, I strongly suggest that you look into the Astronomy Photographer of the Year Awards, who now have a special category specifically for people who process data taken by professional missions. The thing that really surprised me when I heard that the Juno mission had been extended is because the reason why it was going to end this year, it wasn't a thing to do with cost, which is why most missions end, or because it had gotten too far away or something like that. It was to do with the fact that that's as long as they thought the spacecraft would last. And the reason why they only thought it would last until 2021 is because of this enormous radiation that you have around Jupiter. That's the reason why it has these long orbits that only go in close to Jupiter for a very, very short amount of time, so that most of the spacecraft's time can be spent away from the planet and not being bombarded with radiation. And it turns out that Juno has actually survived remarkably well, much better than they thought it was going to. It's done a lot more very close passes than was expected, and now the mission is being extended until 2025. However, I should imagine if they are planning on keeping going, if there looks like there is going to be a sign of the spacecraft flagging, they will choose to crash it early rather than waiting for it to break down. Because the reason why they wanted to crash the spacecraft was because they didn't want to risk it contaminating one of Jupiter's icy moons. So there's several moons around Jupiter, such as Europa and Ganymede, which might possibly have a liquid water ocean and so might possibly be habitable for life. And not just habitable, but inhabited. If there is life somewhere in the solar system other than here on Earth, people think it's probably going to be on one of these icy moons. So you don't want to risk damaging that with your alien spacecraft. And so That's the reason why they want to crash it into Jupiter, to kind of make sure that it doesn't contaminate these other worlds.
Yeah, anyone who remembers the end of the Cassini mission at Saturn is the same thing. It was Enceladus has a subsurface ocean beneath its icy crust, and that's the reason they crashed, you know, purposely crashed Cassini into Saturn. But just reading the sort of the latest from NASA about the Juno mission, it's going to be doing some flybys of the Galilean moons, as I said, but also the potentially looking at Jupiter's rings, which, you know, not a lot of people know that Jupiter has rings, but it has these faint rings, this faint ring system. I suppose those moon flybys also potentially mean more amazing images and more amazing data for citizen scientists to download and process themselves. But yeah, it's going to be another great year for space flight and for astronomy, looks like, doesn't it, Ez?
But if observation is more your thing, then we're going to hand over to Chris Bramley and Paul Manny, who will tell you everything that's coming up in our night sky in 2021.
2021 is set to be a great year for stargazing and observing the night sky. Here to discuss what we can all look forward to appearing over the horizon in the next 12 months, we welcome back longtime observer, the magazine's reviews editor, Paul Money. Hi, Paul. Welcome back.
Now then, Chris. Yes, thank you very much. Yes, it's looking forward to this year.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, a great start to 2021 already. We've had a lovely close gathering of Jupiter, Saturn and Mercury already at the start of January. And what other approaches and conjunctions are on your target list in 2021?
Well, a lot of them tend to happen in the first part of the year, the first half roughly, because that's when we've got the bright planets close to each other. But Jupiter gets in on the act once again, because on February the 11th, we got Jupiter and Venus very close together. But the trouble is, they're in the morning sky, you know, we have to get up for that. But it's also very low down in the on the horizon in twilight. But, you know, they're bright planets, so that makes them easier to spot in the twilight. And then another one I've got looking forward to is really a close encounter between Mars and the Pleiades cluster. And that's in March the 1st through to the 5th. Really, you're looking for the Mars gradually creeping past the Pleiades. And it's about on conjunction on the 3rd. So it's quite close to the... I mean, I love when we have encounters with the Pleiades, especially the bright planets. So usually it's Mercury or Venus, but now we've got Mars this time. And then talking about Venus... April the 25th, I mean, the two innermost planets, Venus and Mercury, get close together, but they don't just do it once, they actually do it twice, April the 25th, and then May the 28th as well. In fact, they'll be very close, not quite as close as Jupiter and Saturn back in December, but pretty close in the sky, so well worth looking out for as well. And then finally, in terms of really close conjunctions, July the 13th, Venus and Mars get close, and all these are in the evening sky, so they're nice and handy for us to actually observe. They're more likely to be seen. Yes. We still have a few other close encounters sort of thing. For example, Mars gets close to the cluster Messier 35 in Gemini on April the 26th. So if you like deep sky objects and conjunctions, that's another one, because normally I concentrate on the Pleiades, but this would be a nice one with M35. It's a nice... bright cluster for Messier. Not quite as bright as the Pleiades, but a really nice one. So well worth looking for.
Lovely, lovely. Well, that promises to be quite a planet pairing. Staying with the planets and larger solar system bodies, when will be the best times to see them in 2021? And indeed other larger bodies in the solar system?
Well, when it comes to, we're talking about oppositions and the months after opposition, because opposition is when they're visible as the sun sets, but it usually means they're still quite low over in the eastern sky. So it's better to leave them a month or two after that. But in March, we've only got one really in the first half of the year, and that's Vesta, the minor world Vesta. It comes to opposition on March the 4th. Now, this is a particularly good time to see that one because, you know, if you've never seen a minor planet or asteroid, as they used to be called, then this is a good time. Because it's magnitude 6. So keen-eyed people, and I do mean keen-eyed people with really dark skies and no light pollution, have a chance to potentially see that with the naked eye. You know, you need a good chart, and of course the magazine will provide good charts for that in due course. But it's in Leo, and it's quite close to a bright star as well, Theta Leonis, Chiron. So that's another guy. I always like it when they're close to bright stars. It makes it a lot easier to find and to point out to the public.
That's nice. And just remind us again when that's just on the threshold of being visible with the naked eye, isn't it? Magnitude 6.
Yes, yes, magnitude 6. I mean, some keen-eyed can go as faint as 7, but it depends on your sky conditions as well and how high they are in the sky. But magnitude 6 is often made as the limit for naked eye observations. And I've certainly reached magnitude 7, but nowadays with glasses, not quite as good, I'm afraid.
Right, yeah. And what about some of the bigger objects, some of the gas giants? Are they at opposition this year? Sometimes they don't reach opposition, but will they be coming to opposition in 2021?
Yeah, they do. And we have the first up is Saturn in August. In fact, August is doing well because August the 2nd is Saturn and then August the 19th is Jupiter. And this comes back to the fact that last year they were really close together. Well, now Jupiter begins to draw away from Saturn, but they're still reaching opposition in the same month. But I think this year is the last year they'll reach opposition in the same month. Next year, I think Jupiter ends up in July, so it'll completely change. But of course, they're the two main planets. The only thing with shows is that they're still low down. Jupiter's moving away and will be moving, creeping up the ecliptic, but Saturn's still very low on the ecliptic, so not well placed to observe, but they are bright planets. So, you know, you can at least see them with the naked eye. And as we've just seen recently with the recent conjunction, they were quite spectacular, have to say. But then we go to the dimmer planets, and we get Neptune first on September the 14th. Now, that does need, you can use binoculars, but a telescope, you know, a small telescope should spot it quite easily, as long as you've got a good chart from the magazine. So, you know, it's well worth hunting that down. And in small telescopes, I have to say, I think it does look a little bit blue. You know, it's slightly a bluish tinge to it. When it comes to the next one, we're waiting for November the 4th, just before fireworks night. Uranus comes to opposition. This is the jolly green giant sort of thing. Ever since the peas advert, I think, on TV, I've always remembered the jolly green giant. But it's a lot brighter. And Uranus is another of those that is actually usually reaches magnitude 5.8 at opposition. And that's naked eye again. So along with Vesta, you know, it's a potential to try out your naked eye viewing from your site to see how far you can see, how faint you can see. So that's in November. So you can see we're getting quite late. And then the final one I've got listed is Ceres. Ceres now is, of course, a dwarf planet. So, you know, but it actually gets up to magnitude 7 and is November the 27th for its actual opposition. So that'll be a nice one. Again, if you've not picked out a dwarf planet, that's the best one, the brightest. Pluto is extremely faint, so I've not listed that at all because you need a very big telescope for that. But Ceres, definitely. So in this year, pick off Vesta and pick off Ceres. I mean, Ceres was the first asteroid. Vesta was the fourth. So, you know, pick them out and you'll be able to spot them. And again, Ceres, you'll definitely see them with binoculars, as you will with Uranus, and I say larger binoculars will give you Neptune as well. So, you know, well worth hunting them out. But lots of planets in the second half of the year, as we can chat about a bit later.
Yeah. So what about the smaller parts of the solar system? Perhaps the smallest parts we can see, dust grains no bigger than grains of sand, which produce meteors when they collide with Earth's atmosphere. What are the prospects like for this year's meteor showers, Paul? Are there any that peak when the moon's not bright and stealing the limelight?
Well, that's half the battle, isn't it, with meteor showers? We often see them being portrayed, look out for the next meteor shower, and those of us who are in the know are groaning because there's a full moon probably up and they're not taking that into account. So, yeah, the moon has a big effect on them. The best ones I've listed down are May the 6th for each of the Aquarids. They're in the morning sky, so again, it's another one where you need to get up for. You need to wait for the moon to set for that one sort of thing, but, you know, that's another one worth trying for. The rates are low. They're not a high rate, but you know, if you can trace them back to the vicinity of Eta Aquarius, then you will have picked up one of those meteors. Obviously, everybody's favourite has to be the Perseids, and we've got a good year this year, August 11th through to the 13th. Yeah, they're definitely favourable for the Perseids. The moon is in the early evening sky and setting quite quickly, so you get a long night to look out for the Perseids, and they are the favourite. I mean, it's summertime, so hopefully we've got nice, warmish weather to set out or be out in our sun lounger, or should I call that the meteor lounger, so to watch for them, as long as you don't fall asleep. I've done that in the past, lounging out and... It is, you know, but don't, as I say, I have fallen asleep before for an hour or so and then woke up and think, where's that gone? And I've probably missed the best ones, you know. You don't look on the internet then to see what other people have said. But later in the year, we've got fairly good conditions for the Draconids. They're the October the 8th to the 9th. So they're worth looking out for as well. Again, they're not a big shower, but, you know, they get some nice bright ones. And then the Geminids, again, the best after the moon has set. And unfortunately, that's around about 3 a.m.-ish. But then Gemini is best seen on December the 14th in the early hours of the morning. That's when it is highest. So I would definitely go for them as well, except I'd wrap up warm. December the 14th, you definitely want to have winter woolies on, etc., and not to fall asleep on your lounger.
That's probably one to set an alarm for, isn't it? Because you'd probably suffer from exposure if you went out watching the Geminids all night in December. It's quite a bit colder then, isn't it?
And it does make you tired. I mean, and it creeps up on you. I mean, I've done long winter observing sessions, and sometimes you've really got to go in and have a cup of, you know, a coffee or cocoa. You'd probably fall asleep after that, wouldn't you? But definitely coffee to keep you awake, but to keep you warm as well. So, you know, so definitely an alarm for that. And especially with the moon up, I say after 3 a.m., and we've got plenty of hours of darkness. You've got around about 4 hours of darkness to view the meteor. So plenty of time to get a good one. And they have some really bright ones as well. So definitely worth looking out for the Geminids into 2021.
Great, great. So we want the moon out of the way for meteor showers. But of course, there are times when it should be our main focus. For example, in eclipses. What are the prospects like there? What are we going to see any of those in 2021?
Well, the good news is we get a partial eclipse of the sun. It's technically an annular eclipse as it crosses over the Earth's surface. But for us in the UK, we get a partial eclipse of the sun on June the 10th. And of course, as it's during the sun, it's during the day. So, you don't have to get up for this one, Chris. We'll be up. Well, I hope so anyway, unless you've had a really long night observing the night before, because that's technically new moon as well. So, of course, this is the ideal time in the morning, but you've got the June sky, which is of course light nights. So having an eclipse in the daytime compensates, I think, for the light nights, don't you? But yes, that'll be a decent partial eclipse of the sun for the UK. You've got to observe it safely, of course, with specialised solar filters. But it's well worth having a look for that. And we have to wait a very long time before we get decent eclipses in the UK. So make the best of this if we've got clear skies.
Right. I think that's one of the best chances of seeing a solar eclipse in the UK since 2015. So it's definitely worth getting that in the diary and seeing if we can, getting ready to observe that.
And the good news is, because of the annularity of it and the popularity of these things on the internet now, even if we're cloudy, there's always the chance you can watch a webcast of the eclipse taking place. So I find that now an exciting part of astronomy, in that you don't necessarily have to miss out. If someone somewhere has got clear skies, 9 times out of 10, there's a good chance they'll actually be projected onto the internet so we can all watch as well.
Oh, that's good to know. Good stuff. I think there is a total eclipse of note in 2021 happening on the 4th of December, but it's happening over Antarctica. So
there's not going to be
not
many
one
sites
that's particularly particularly approachable, shall we say.
which is a shame, but again, you never know. I mean, the tip of Argentina gets it, and the tip of part of Australia and sort of South Africa actually pick it up as well. So perhaps the South African observatory might be in the right line. So I don't know about that, but yes, this is the thing about eclipses, that literally they can occur across any part of the Earth's surface. So you've got to be in the right place at the right time to get the proper totality. At least we get the June the 10th one to see in the Northern Hemisphere. And fingers crossed, we actually have some clear skies. But it isn't just the sun, of course, is it? We have lunar eclipses. And it's not a big eclipse, but we've got on November the 19th a partial lunar eclipse. The slight problem with that one, it occurs at moonset. So again, in the early hours of the morning. But, you know, if you want to watch the moon start to go into the Earth's shadow just before it sets, I think actually a setting eclipse moon is just as interesting and exciting. I've actually observed some years ago, in fact, I was reviewing one of our telescopes many years ago, and I used it to watch the moon rise during an eclipse. And that was quite something to watch the moon. And you know how the moon sort of like appears to wobble because of the atmospheric refraction effect sort of thing. And it was really something. I mean, amazingly, I actually had a clear horizon. I mean, how shocking is that? Clear, it is. Yes, yeah, should have had the champagne out for that. So, you know, at moonset, you're going to have a good clear horizon, uncluttered, to actually see that. But, you know, if you like eclipses, that's one to look out for as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And, of course, during a lunar eclipse, the moon can turn red, can't it, across its face, the so-called blood moon. But that's only when the moon is entirely within the umbra, I think, the kind of the deepest part of the shadow of the Earth cast into space. Is that going to be happening on November 19th?
It will start to look red, yes, but we'll lose the main effect once it's set, unfortunately. But, you know, we should start to see it change. The biggest problem is, of course, that being a partial, it won't be quite as dramatic, but the moon will definitely have a chunk taken out of it. It'll look as if it's got a chunk taken out of it. And, of course, the moon doesn't actually turn technically red. It's the refraction of the light of our atmosphere that causes it. So it's effectively like all the sunsets and sunrises happening at once, actually as seen from the moon. So the moon would see the Earth as a ring of fire in that respect, sort of thing. So the sun would be refracted all around the rim of the Earth because of our atmosphere, and that then piles in onto the lunar surface, giving us the red part of the eclipse. We see the red, deep red eclipse, and they can be quite dramatic when we get a good eclipse. And again, you mentioned 2015, we had a really good and clear sky for the entirety lunar eclipse in September, I think it was 2015, and that was absolutely gorgeous, and I actually got the whole lot. That was a shock.
I remember that because I remember it was setting my alarm and getting out and going out when the moon was quite high, and going out, leaving the house, and I had to walk a bit of a distance in the dead of night to get to the area of sky where it was visible. And it was rather surreal getting out there and then looking around and there you are confronted with this blood red moon. It was a bizarre experience, and really really kind of took my breath away.
It can do. And, it reminds me of one time when I used to live with my parents, a little tiny village, right across the other side of the hedge was the remains of a churchyard. and I always remember seeing the blood red moon hanging above that. And I tell you what, there was a chill went down my spine that night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Oh, goodness me. Oh, well, that's good. That's something to look forward to. Is there anything else that we should be on the lookout for in the next 12 months, then, Paul? There are lots of things, lots of night sky events that we haven't mentioned, of course. Are there any highlights that you suggest to us?
Yeah, I mean, we've got an occultation. I mean, occultations are a bit of an oddity sort of thing, because unless they're a really bright star, most of them get missed by the public. But would you believe on December 24th, so it's the morning, early morning of Christmas Eve, the moon occults the bright star Eta Leonis, which means it'll also be above Regulus. Now, Regulus is one of those where we often mention in the calendar we put out, the Astrophotographer of the Year calendar. We often mention that the moon is close to Regulus this morning. Well, in this particular case, it's above Regulus, but it's also occulting Eta Leonis as well. So a double bill there. You've got Regulus, but you've also got an occultation. There are other fainter occultations, it has to be said. There's one on September the 2nd. And there's, again, unfortunately, an early morning occultation of Epsilon Geminorum by the moon, Mebutsa, if I've pronounced that right. You know, they're tongue twisters, some of these names, aren't they? So there are occultations going on. But there are other things as well. We're still with the moon. There's the supermoon on March the 28th. This is, it's fallen into common terminology now, because it's actually the perigee moon. That's the when the moon is closest to the Earth, and when it
yes,
happens to occur
the
with full
name
moon.
For that is perigee syzygy moon, isn't it? Bit of a mouthful.
I'm glad you,
said
that.
Slightly easier to say.
Yeah. I've always had fun.
It's even
to
worse
say
to spell.
That.
I won't try yes, spelling exactly. It right now. Yes.
Exactly. So, that the best one is March the 28th, but the definition is a bit broad. It was done by an astrologer, after all. So you could probably say sort of thing from February, March and April, each of the full moons will be supermoons. But March the 28th is a particularly good supermoon. So it'll be when the moon is closest to us and it therefore looks the largest. Although, to be honest, unless you photograph them from one full moon to the other, you can't really discern it with the naked eye. But photography you can, and it's very instructive to put them together, show them.
It really is, isn't it? Yeah. When you do a Photoshop montage of the smallest moon against the supermoon, maybe like half of one, half of the other, the difference is quite striking when you see it that way. But just to the naked eye, it's not immediately apparent that it's that much brighter or that much bigger, is it?
That's why you find a lot of astronomers say, oh, it's just another full moon. But I say, it's worth looking out for, you know, that's where, I mean, the moon itself. And the moon, I mean, we can't list them all, but I will list one. The moon does have lots of encounters with the planets during the course of each month, let alone throughout the year. And coming up fairly soon, one I think is worth looking at. I always like it when the moon and a star and a planet line up. And on March the 19th, we've got moon, we've got the Aldebaran, the bright red eye of Taurus the bull, and Mars. And of course, Mars is red as well. So you've got two red objects and the moon forming a line on March the 19th. So that, I think, is well worth actually looking out for as well. We mentioned Mercury and Venus early in the year and sort of thing, and April to May is the best evening apparition for Mercury when it gets high enough. And I remember last year during the first lockdown, I had the neighbours out looking at Mercury because it was right next to Venus, because Venus was a brilliant guide to it. And so, you know, April to May this year, we'll have a similar situation. So that will be an ideal time to pick up Mercury. But if you're a morning person, Mercury puts on a very good morning apparition during October as well. So well worth looking out for that. And of course, you know, there are other things happening. Many of us look forward to and keep an eye out on the northern horizon from May to late August for the noctilucent clouds, you know. So, you know, and they're so unpredictable that you just can't predict when there's going to be a display. So you keep your eyes peeled to the north, looking out. It's a bit like looking out for aurora. I mean, around about the equinoxes, I always keep an eye out for the aurora borealis, northern lights. So they're always worth looking out for, and that depends on the activity of the sun. But the noctilucent clouds, they're the summer. They make up for the light nights for summer that you get potential display of noctilucents. Yeah, so that's good.
These are the highest clouds in the atmosphere, aren't they? They're right on the edge of the atmosphere, on the border with space, aren't they?
And they're so high up, they're still in direct sunlight, even though for us. Yeah, exactly. The sun set is below the horizon, but of course, being light nights, the sun isn't that far below the horizon, so it's still a quite lightish night. But normal clouds, they go up to about 5 miles, so they will be in darkness. And I've got plenty of photographs where I've got sort of dark clouds, ordinary clouds, and then the noctilucent clouds shining above them, and in some cases shining through gaps in those dark clouds as well. So that can be quite something. They have some lovely colours sometimes to them as well. They're generally a silvery blue, but they do have some interesting colour variations if you look closely, especially in binoculars. And there's a lot of sometimes fast-moving details, so definitely one to look out for. And then really, the end of the year, I mean, is quite... I love this, where we get lots of planets visible in one go. And the end of December, say the last week of December, so from Christmas Day through to the January the 1st of 2022, we'll have Mercury, Venus, Saturn, Jupiter, Neptune and Uranus all visible in the evening sky. And then if you're really dedicated, you can stay up for Mars in the morning. And on the 28th, there's Mars and the crescent... Oh, sorry, the 29th, Mars and the crescent moon. So you'll have the moon and Mars as well. So, and there is Ceres in the area of sky as well. So if you wanted to throw in the odd asteroid or dwarf planet, you could do that as well. So there's like a plethora of planets and sort of solar system bodies available to observe. And those diehards could also argue if you did the observations carefully of the sun in the daytime, you've also got the biggest object in the solar system on display. So lots and lots of things to look out for.
Something of a solar system marathon to end the year with, then.
It would be, yeah, it'd be an ideal time. And it isn't impossible, but Pluto would just about be visible, but it would be very, very low. You'd have to get that first, but that would be a real challenge, to be honest, a real challenge.
That's quite something. Well, what a way to end... end the year. That's really something to look forward to. Yeah. Well, Paul, thank you for talking to us about the delights of the night sky to come in 2021. And I hope that gives you listeners a little bit to look forward to over the coming months. As ever, keep an eye out for coverage of all these events in the magazine and on skynightmagazine.com. Here's to clear skies.
I'll go to that, yes.
Although Mars is fading and its appearance at the start of February is a long cry from the brilliant disk that was on view last October, the planet will remain interesting to watch with the naked eye over the month as it gets closer to the beautiful Pleiades open cluster at the month's close. As February begins, however, Mars is in southern Aries, approximately midway between the stars Hamel and Menkar. Despite its diminished brightness, the planet's orange hue will still be obvious at this time. Over the course of the month, Mars nudges further east. On the evening of the 16th, the red planet passes south of the star Delta Arietis, and then a waxing crescent moon joins Mars on the 18th, with the moon's disk appearing just below the red planet in the early evening. Mars then moves from Aries into Taurus on the 23rd of February, and it remains the most northerly planet, appearing 55 degrees up as darkness falls. As the month closes, Mars will be ready to pass just to the south of the Pleiades, which will be visible in the early evening, extending the line of Orion's belt up and right guides you to the orange star Aldebaran in Taurus. Keep the belt line going to arrive close to Mars at the month's close.
So that's it from us this month. Make sure you pick up the February issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine to find out even more information about the best stargazing sites of 2021, as well as hearing all about the details for the upcoming Astronomer Photographer of the Year competition, learning about the ups and downs of planetary robotic exploration, and discovering why Jupiter's moon Europa appears to be glowing. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast or Spotify.